For this evening's Dhamma talk, I'd like to speak a little bit to the topic of the Dhamma Sutta, which we just recited, and talk a little bit about the values and the ideas that are represented there. And as I mentioned briefly before, this is one of those regular texts. It says Abhinhan Pachavekita Bhang, to be reflected on frequently, again and again, and very typically as done as a daily reflection in many monastic traditions, in the Theravadan tradition, one of the basic texts that monastics learn. And so, comment on each of them in turn. This one says, Vevaniyamhi Ajupagato, is given a very literal translation of that, is I've become without caste, or I've become casteless, or Varna. And the Varna is literally the system of castes in ancient India. And that may come as no surprise to most people here. They probably don't identify themselves as being from a particular caste or not, so in the literal sense is still very relevant in some forms of Buddhism, obviously in Indian Buddhism, also Sri Lankan Buddhism. The Sangha, the biggest Sangha group, the Siam Nikaya there, is still chosen on the basis of caste. And so a little bit of reflection on the first point of this wouldn't go astray. Perhaps they would have the Nava Dhamma Sutta recited or something like that, the nine Dhammas, nine reflections instead of the ten. But in any case, the notion of caste or something like that is not the particular form of it is Indian, but the general idea is found in all cultures, and even a supposedly classless culture like Australia actually, of course, is very has very strong class divisions in many ways, which are in terms of income, where you live, what kind of job you do, and also affects things like your speech, the kind of cultural activities you go to, and so on. And so all of these are affected by notions of divisions in society. Rich and poor, upper class and lower class, educated, non-educated, and Apple or Mac or PC or whatever it may be. All these things that divide societies up. And so in the state of a samana, according to Buddhism, the Buddha was always outside of the caste system. So he proposed this as being something which was external to the caste system, as opposed to, for example, the Brahmanical conception that for a Brahmin that one of the stages of life was a renunciate. But the Buddha said that this is something which is separate from. So each, when entering the Sangha, that one leaves notions of caste behind. And that has a number of very important implications. One thing is that in one of the things that divides caste is what they call commensality, and it's a very important concept in anthropology. Commensality means who can eat together. And in the caste system, then people from different castes would be not allowed to eat together. It would be a terrible crime for a Brahmin to eat the food of a Chandala or of a lower caste, or even a Sudra or something like that. But when they, because the bhikkhunis would enter the Sangha, they would all share the same meal, and so we all eat the same food. So this notion of commensality is actually very crucial to forming a sense of identity, and we still do that today. This is one of the markers that we use to divide off, for example, the fully ordained sangha as being those who should receive the food which is formally offered, and to take the food first and so on. So even in a relatively classless and relatively less hierarchical structures that we have today in monasteries like ours, still those things are observed and they have a certain function, they have a certain purpose, but they should never be misapprehended or be taken to be something more than they're not. So the notion that, you know, kind of leaving behind your class or something like that is actually, it's a very powerful one, and it's not it's one which creates a very, very interesting, very powerful dynamic in the Sangha, because the reality is we do have a very diverse community in the Sangha. There are monks who are friends of mine who have renounced fortunes worth billions of dollars to take ordination. And of course there's plenty of others like myself who've renounced about $20 or $30 or something to go forth. Or such as, I do have some guitars, so they were worth a bit more than that. So it's all but I mean I shouldn't say that. I mean, I shouldn't kind of pretend to be kind of thing. I also come from a middle class background, so even my family's also not too badly off, and so on. That's my own background, and everyone here has their own different backgrounds and have given up different things when they come here. But we shouldn't bring those expectations of how we've lived before when we come to the monastery. And this is something which is quite difficult, and especially for people who are a bit older. It's very difficult because you learn to be treated, for example, in a workplace or a family situation or something like that. You learn to be treated with a certain degree of, you know, of responsibility and respect and so on within that position. And then when you come to join the Sangha, it's always quite difficult because you start again at the beginning. So it's, you know, for everyone to just appreciate that, that's an extra kind of difficulty. For those who join the Sangha at a younger age, that tends to be a little bit easier because they're used to starting things out and they expect to be learning from the beginning. But all of us really need to have that kind of attitude, to remember that that if we're just starting out, then that's all that it is, and we're just a matter for us to learn patiently and to go on little bit by little bit and to pick up all the things that we need to do. So the next factor here it talks about is parapatibandha means jivita, means that one's livelihood is dependent on others. Okay, so this is also a very important reflection, because we have, and I think perhaps especially in the West, that we have an ideology of what they call sometimes rugged individualism, and this idea of being a self-made man, that you should be able to do things by yourself and stand up for your own and so on and so forth. And so there's a certain degree of truth to that, but there's also a certain degree of arrogance and conceit to that as well. But as part of the Sangha life, then our life is always dependent on others to a very profound level. And this is something that we should reflect on constantly. We look, for example, just as a simple reflection, we can look around us right now here in this cave. We can look at the shape of the walls. You remember that every inch of that surface has been worked over and laboured on by the hard work. Some of the people here, many of the people have worked here themselves on the cave. Other people have also worked here. So every inch here has been worked over. Effort has been put in, care has been put in, time has been put in, blood in some cases has been put in, especially for the jobs that I did, tended to leave a few blood stains around the place. So everything, the concrete, the floor that we're sitting on, the mats that we have here, the clothes that we're wearing, the Buddha on the shrine, the candles, every single thing that's around us, the seats that we sit on, the cushions, has been given by others. It's something which we receive. And our life is constantly like that, right through our day, the house that we stay in, the kuti that we're in, the food that we eat, the water that we drink, the coffee that we sustain our wakefulness with, the chanting sheets that we use for the chanting. Everything has been offered to us freely from dana, and nothing else. So we don't charge for anything. And so that's an incredibly pure livelihood, incredibly pure. And that's something to be respected and taken very carefully and very cautiously in our monastic life, that we should be most to try to go out of our way as much as possible to treat all of those things with as much care and respect, because they've been offered, and to take the greatest degree of responsibility with the things that are offered, and also to have the greatest degree of appreciation and gratitude to those who make the offerings. Something which is each tiny little thing should never be scorned, it should never be laughed at, it should never be cynical or contemptuous because something's offered that's not good or that's not useful or something like that. Anything, even the smallest thing, even if there isn't a use for it, has been offered with a good intention and should be received with humility and with gratitude. So that this gives others the chance to make merit by making the offerings, and it gives us the chance to purify our livelihood and to remember that in the monastery that we get lots of visitors, we get lay people come and they're very kind and things like that, and to always be extremely reticent to ask for anything or suggest anything or hint anything like that you might need. Usually for the monastics that we wouldn't ask for anything from anyone unless it's our close immediate family, and even then we should be very careful, or somebody who's expressly given an invitation. But even someone who's expressly given an invitation shouldn't necessarily ask for anything until you're really sure that they mean it, and even then ask to well within what they have offered. So this is something to be very cautious of. Okay, the next point here is anyo me akapo karaniyo, which means that the things which are suitable or appropriate for me have changed. Something like that. It's a bit difficult to translate that one literally, but it means something like that, that my behaviour, the things that I should do, the way I should live, should be different from the norm, from that of the household life. And so this refers to things like the care that we use in our physical acts, the acts of our body, to be restrained and have a good deportment in how we're living, to know the right way to behave, for example, if we're in the village, going for pindabhata or for any work or something that we have in the town, then we should know to act with restraint and so on. And we look at the sekhiya rules that govern various kinds of things there. If we're, for example, visiting lay people's homes for a dana, or we've just been invited there or something like that, also to remember to keep a sense of quietness about that, not to be uptight and stiff. It's not a matter of being rigid and uptight and stiff, but just a matter of being a little bit careful and a little bit having a sense of restraint and collectedness about one's behaviour. This is really kind of the main thing which is important. And this has a number of reasons for doing this, but one reason is that it's simply a matter of mindfulness training, and that we keep a check on the kind of the wilder impulses or that we tend to get lost in, the kinds of behaviors that we tend to lose our mindfulness and get too caught up in the moment with. But it also so has that kind of inner factor of inner development, but it also has an external factor as well, which is very important, which is just to maintain the good reputation of the Sangha. And this is something which you can see has characterized the Buddhist Sangha since the early times. And in the Indian culture, a lot of the samanas would have sort of quite extreme deportment and things like that. So they would, be naked, or they wouldn't bathe at all, and so on. And reading some of the Jatakas, that there's even these verses about there's like the proverbial smelliness of the ascetics. Okay, so there's these kind of verses that say, one would want to avoid the ascetics because of their bad smell. And so this was one of the things that's been a part of the Buddhist tradition, is that the ascetic practice doesn't follow these kinds of extremes. And so we're always careful with things like our bodily cleanliness, for example, not letting nose hairs grow out, sticking out like those of devil worshippers, for example, is one of the rules in the Vinaya. So these are things which are, they're not difficult things, they're not complicated, but they're things which we need to pay attention to and to just be a little bit careful of in our monastic life. Right, next one. I'm trying to get them all in the right order. Kachin kome atta silato na upavadati is there anything in my sila, in my keeping the precepts, which I can fault myself with, or I could find something wrong with my sila? So this is something, again, to be reflected on quite frequently, and so to remember that the sila here refers primarily to the important ethical rules which we're supposed to be keeping, rules like, say, keeping rules of speech, not to lie and to have gentle speech, and speech which is harmonious and supportive and truthful and meaningful and so on. And so to reflect, have I been using speech well today? This is one aspect of our sila, or say our physical conduct. Have we been acting in a way that's harmful or damaging to animal life or plant life? Have we been fulfilling the duties that we're required to do in a monastery? And this also is, of course, a part of sila. It's not just keeping precepts, but it's also the duties and the jobs that we do in the monastery is also part of the practice of sila. So this is also something which is essential to our spiritual life. Don't think of it as something which is peripheral or an extra or a distraction from the spiritual life, but far from it. It's part of sila, and therefore part of the Eightfold Path, and part of the threefold training in sila, samadhi, panya. And the Buddha talked about, and in the Vinaya there's many details of the different kinds of duties that are required for us to help build the community and keep the community sustained, looking after the monastery, and keeping things clean, making sure they're maintained, and so on and so forth. And one of the great examples of that was Venerable Sariputta. And even though he's, of course, one of the most senior members of the whole Sangha and the most renowned for having the wisdom which was like the wisdom of the Buddha himself, but he would, every day, he made a practice that he would be the last monk in the monastery who would go out on alms round, and when everybody else had gone out on alms round, he would walk around the whole monastery and check to see whether anything was messy. If anything needed sweeping, he would sweep it. If there were any robes that had been left out, he would put them away. If there's anything that needed tidying up, he would tidy it up. If there's any rubbish there, he would clean that up and put that away. And he would do that every day as one of his self-imposed duties before he went out on alms round. So this is a very wonderful example for how we should, the attitude that we should take towards the duties that we should be keeping in the monastery. So that it's not just a matter of getting away with what we can get away with. It's not just a matter of trying not to be involved with things so that I can be peaceful and quiet myself and never mind about the fact that everybody else is working twice as hard. But it's about contributing to the community life in the most effective and productive way that we can. And remember also that these things come around. And I was just discussing this a little bit earlier and referring to the thing I talked about a few days ago, some time ago, about the idea of the long-term perspective of the holy life. And remember, you know, there's many monks that I know who really don't like to be part of community life, and they really would much rather live by themselves and not get involved in things, and they can be quite critical of monks who, you know, build monasteries and do a lot of teaching and things like that. But when you look at those monks when they get old, what happens to them? Well, they're lonely and they're by themselves and they don't have anybody to care for them. And so don't be like that. You know, on the other hand, there are other monks who have given so much to the community and worked so hard, monks like, say, Ajahn Brahm or Ajahn Pasana, we'll be visiting in December, and they've given so much over so many years that you know, whenever they want to go on retreat or do something for themselves, everyone's so happy to be able to help them to do that, and would do anything to be able to you know, keep a monk who's like that in a kuti by themselves and to support them for a retreat for as long as they wanted to do so. So this is that result of karma. It's not nothing mysterious about it, because they've done so much to help others that these results happen. And so these things are all a part of that reflection on sila. And so it's not just the reflection on whether oneself would find anything worthy of criticism, but then also the next reflection is whether anybody else would find anything worthy of criticism. Not necessarily anybody else, but especially the wise would find anything worthy of criticism. And so this is a kind of external standard of sila. So not necessarily, of course, you know, you'll always find that somebody will criticize you. And the Buddha said that nobody ever, in the past, the present or the future, has been either wholly blamed or wholly praised. And so that's a very good thing to bear in mind. Nobody's, you're not going to satisfy everybody. And there's one story of in the suttas of a man who wanted to get a teaching. He had a question. He went to see Venerable Sariputta, and he gave a very concise answer. And he went to see Venerable Moggallana, and Moggallana just sat there in samadhi. And he went to see Ananda, and Ananda gave a very long answer. And then he went to the Buddha and he said, "Oh, these monks are telling me these different things." And the Buddha said, "Well, some people will just never be satisfied." He always finds something to criticize. People could criticize the Buddha, they criticize Sariputta and Moggallana, they certainly criticize Ananda quite a lot. So I'm sure they'll find plenty of things to criticize with us as well. So this isn't necessarily about those things which are not wise criticisms or important criticisms, but those things. this rule is what if there was somebody who was wise, who really had a good understanding of the Dhamma and practice and so on, then what kinds of things would they be critical of, and to pay attention to that in our lives, or what kinds of things would they praise? And so this can sometimes also be a good reflection for us. So the next one is here. Sabbe hime ye himana pehinana bhavo vina bhavo hi. Is everything which is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. So this is a reflection on impermanence and the non-ownership of things. So again, from the from a worldly perspective, that our happiness is based on the happiness of attachments. We have a family, or we have an idea that we want to have a family or friends or job or house and so on and so forth, which is going to somehow be ours and be a part of, we can surround ourselves with that, and that will be our support or our context or our something which almost becomes a part of us. But the reality is, of course, that all of those things will become lost, will become separated, just a matter of time. And even the inner things that we think are important, our own body, our own mind, is always changing. Our ideas are changing, our perceptions, our emotions, and so on, are changing. If you fall in love with somebody, then after a while that goes away. This is why the Buddha didn't say to something which you often hear in modern spiritual circles, is like, trust your feelings. The Buddha didn't say that, okay? Because your feelings are sometimes accurate and sometimes deluded, and your feelings change as well. So feelings aren't always right, and so don't. And the Buddha said, don't always trust your ideas, because your ideas are sometimes right and sometimes wrong. Your reasoning is sometimes right and sometimes wrong. So all of these things are never completely trustworthy, and they'll all become separated from you at some stage. So the only thing that really stays with you is the Dhamma. And the Dhamma, of course, just means the Dhamma of impermanence. So things are always, you can always trust impermanence. You can always trust the fact that you're going to be left high and dry. You can always trust the fact that if it feels good, it's not going to last. That's what you can always put your faith into. So this is a very, very important reflection, and it's one of the distinguishing features of the Arians, of the stream enterer. The stream enterer, both when a normal person, a Tujana, and an Arian, will both experience pleasant and painful feelings, and they both come into encounter with pleasant things and painful things and so on. So the difference is that when a Patujana gets something pleasant, so for example they're offered a pleasant meal, or they get a nice book, or they get something that they like, then they just get caught up in the pleasure and the pleasant aspects of those things, so they get attached. And so then they experience pain and disappointment when that thing changes and disappears. For an Aryan, when they have that kind of experience, then they'll reflect that this too is impermanent. This too will not last. This too is conditioned. So it's a very, very powerful reflection. It's a very simple one. But don't underestimate it. But remember, this is a very good reflection to make, you know, really at the point of contact, of any contact with anything which is going to be pleasant or exciting or thrilling or whatever. And to say, it's okay, but that, you know, if it's something which is allowable, then that's okay, but that's just all it is. The most delicious Lindt chocolate is just a delicious Lindt chocolate, and it just lasts for a few seconds and then it's gone. And as my friend Ajahn Chandoko said to me, as after we'd finished eating an ice cream sundae together, and he said to me, I know sense pleasures are impermanent, but do they have to be that impermanent? So this is that separation from everything that we love. Okay, the next reflection, kama sakon is kama dayano, kama yoni, kama bandhu, kama patisarano, yam kamam karisami, kalyanam wa papakam watasa dayado bhavisamiti. So I am the owner of my kama, the heir, the dayana of my kama. I inherit the kama that I've done in my past life. I'm born of my kama. Okay, so this is the idea that whatever birth we take, whenever we get reborn, that this is directed by our karma. So the idea of kamasakam, I should mention kamasakam here, the first one, that one is the owner of one's kama. Now that means you don't get anybody else's kama, right? So you can't, make up for your own bad kama by getting some good kama from somebody else or something like that, which a lot of people seem to think that they can do. But the basic idea of kama, the whole point of it is that you personally, it's yours and you're responsible for it. Okay, so in the heir of kama, the kama yoni is the born of the kama. So according to Buddhism, wherever we get born, and it is dependent on our kama. It doesn't mean that, of course, everything in our life is dependent, determined by kama, but it does mean that the actual place that we get reborn in is determined by our kama. And so you might compare that, for example, remember that kama is basically a choice. You compare that with, say, just a simple analogy is just going on a voyage. I remember my grandfather told me once that he actually really wanted, he was born in Lancashire and from a very extremely poor, impoverished, working class family. And as a young boy, I think about 16 or so, he decided that he wants to get out. And I think he was one of what they call the 10-pound Pongs. You get a ticket for £10 or something like that. But he really wanted to go to Canada. But he couldn't get a ticket. So he had to come to Australia instead. So that's a choice. Yeah, choice to go to Canada and make a life, or to go to Australia. So that's a kama, to go to Canada or to go to Australia. That's your kama. But of course, it doesn't mean that everything that happens to him in Australia is directly determined by kama. Of course, it's all determined in some sense. If he hadn't made the choice to come to Australia in the first place, he wouldn't be here and he wouldn't be able to experience those things. But some things that he experienced are then kama. But then also other things that he experienced were the result of other choices that he made once he got here. So for example, when he arrived at Fremantle, the first thing he saw was people lying sunbathing on the beach in Fremantle. And so he said, that looks good, having just come from Lancashire, decided to spend the whole of the next day lying on the beach in Fremantle in the middle of summer. And ended up in hospital that night. So that probably wouldn't have happened to him if he'd gone to Canada. So that's his kama. And later in his life, is there any relation? I don't know, but later in his life he got skin cancer and eventually died of cancer. So whether that was actually connected with that experience, or not, I don't know, but this is the idea of kama. So kama sarano is an interesting one. Kama is my refuge. And kama bandhu is related to my kama. So this bandhu is a word that's used for relatives in an ordinary sense. I think that can be taken in quite a literal sense, that it tends to be that our relatives and the people that we meet in our life tends to be people who we share a common kama with for one reason or another. So that can be quite a frightening thought to induce some sobering reflections. We're going to get reborn within the next life. And then kama patisarano, kama in a sense is our refuge. Venerable Tanisaro translates it as arbitrator. I'm not quite sure what he's getting at there, but patisarano means the refuge. And so it's actually almost sort of giving kind of a more positive aspect of kama, is that if we have our, kama isn't something to be frightened of, kama is something to be understood. And when we have our good kama, then this is our refuge, it's our support. And I always remember this very beautiful sutta where Nahanama, the Sakyan, sometimes stumbles. He said, sometimes you go into the Buddha, he said, sometimes I like fall over or something, and I think, oh, what would happen if I had an accident? I fall over, I lose my mindfulness. And what would happen if I had an accident and then I was to die there losing my mindfulness? Maybe I'd be reborn in a bad place or something. And the Buddha said, Ma bahayi mahanama, ma bahayi mahanama. Do not fear, mahanama, do not fear. And somebody such as you who's lived a long time and practiced Dhamma, kept sila, and been generous for so many years, that it's not possible for you after death to go to a bad destiny. So this is that idea of karma as a refuge. So all of those good deeds that we do, just the little deeds that we do every day, are all building up and making a refuge and a place of safety. Okay, so this is the reflection of the karma. Okay, the next reflection is katam bhutasamer indiva vidi gatam siddhi, which means translation used in the Ajahn Chah tradition, it's the days and nights are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? The phrase is a little bit difficult to translate literally into English, but that captures the nuance of it quite well. Ratindiva is a day and night, and then vi di wat tanti, vi is a intensive, and then ati is an even more intensive. So viti is like super intensive. Viti vattanti, and to vattanti is to go by. So the viti vattanti means to rush on by relentlessly. And that says katam bhuta same. The important term there is the term bhuta. Bhuta is a word which always refers to conditioning or to having come to a state of being because of certain causes and conditions. So where am I at, and how do I take responsibility for where am I at because of what I've been doing? So I'm creating myself. I'm taking responsibility for developing my own personality, for developing my own my mind, my consciousness, and my practice, and all of these things. And how am I putting in the conditions which are creating a state or a progress in that? So this is what that means on a more philosophical level. On a practical level, basically, how well am I spending my time? What am I doing with my days? And in the monastic lifestyle, we take pains to keep things simple, and not having an evening meal, for example, and to restrict the hours that we do work and so on. So in the normal life, normally you do an 8-hour work day. But the 8-hour work day is really only the start of it, because very often people will do some work even before they go off to their office or job or whatever. And then when you come home in the evening, there's other things to be done. There's still cooking and cleaning and washing and laundry and all of these kinds of things that need to be done. It doesn't mean that people only work in that time. So for a monastic lifestyle, we, because of the way that we set up a monastery, which is actually very efficient, then the amount of physical time we have to spend to sustain our livelihood is kept limited, kept within quite a small amount. Just a few hours a day is enough to do all of the chores and the work that we need to provide our monastery and so on, and to keep that going, and to keep it in good condition and all of those things. So that means that we're left with many hours where time is our own. And I like living like that. I like living, having the opportunity to practice as I choose, whether to practice at night time or in the day, or whether to do more study or more practice and so on and so forth. I like to have that freedom, and I like to think that the people who come to a monastery like this are mature and motivated and sincere, and that they also appreciate that chance to be able to develop their practice in their own way, and they're not going to require sort of somebody sort of standing behind them telling them what to do all the time. And in some monasteries, of course, that's what it is. It's, they're very regimented, and almost every time in the day is dictated to you what you're doing. So I don't like to do it like that. That's not the experience that I had from the Thai forest tradition. Nor is it, I think, what was done in the early Buddhist Sangha, as far as I can determine. It seems to have been a lot of freedom for different individuals and different monks and nuns and so on to spend each day in different kinds of ways. So, of course, the most important thing in terms of spending time is have a constant and regular meditation practice, and one where one feels that meditation is able to deepen and to gain maturity and strength over the months and over the years of staying in a monastery. And so to keep up that effort and that interest in the meditation practice is not something that's easy. That is something that we need to do. So if we start to get bored and dull and apathetic with meditation, then we're likely to find that that's going to result in a more bored and apathetic attitude to the holy life in general. So it's very important to keep that keenness about one's meditation, to be a bit snappy about things. And when you finish washing up after the meal, to be a bit snappy about getting that finished and getting back to your kuti so you can do some meditation. Again, after drinks time in the evening, to not let that drift on too long, but just get that finished and then go and do some meditation. And to make sure that actually when you're meditating, that you're applying yourself properly. Meditation shouldn't be a time just to sort of drift around vaguely and sort of go into a kind of sort of trancy zones kind of thing for a half an hour or an hour, and then come out of it and feel virtuous because you've been sitting. You've done your day's quotient of sitting. But it should be care and a sense of attention to each moment, each minute in the meditation, each moment. Paying attention to the breath or one's meditation object. So this is very important, just to remember that the conditions in the monastery change. There are always dangers lurking around, and this monastery is no exception. very dangerous, for example, from bushfires. And any day, really, we could just burn down, the monastery could burn down. We could lose all of the buildings here. It could very easily happen. Then we wouldn't have anywhere to stay. You might be complaining about not getting enough time to meditate or this or that, but if the monastery burns down, you're not going to have anywhere. It's all going to be finished. Yeah? Well, I don't know if it's going to be finished. We're probably all going to probably all go up to what Buddha Dharma and lump on Venerable Kemawara's doorstep or something like that. But whatever. These things are completely uncertain, or else your health changes. And again, this happens all the time. You know, every year that goes by, we have somebody in the monastery has some kind of health problem, physical health problem, mental health problem, some kind of breakdown, or they break their leg, or their hip, or they have a triple bypass, or all of them together, or whatever it may be. You're not going to, and it's going to happen to all of us eventually. Okay, next one. 9. Kachi nukho ahang sunyagare abhira ma miti, which means, do I delight in an empty dwelling? So of course this particular one has both a kind of a lower and a higher meaning. The lower meaning is, of course, do you like staying in your kuti by yourself, or in your room, or your cave, or your ledge, or whatever it happens to be staying in, and also the higher meaning, of course, the abiding in emptiness, being one of the great meditation attainments of the arahants. But seeing as this is a reflection for basic monastic training, Perhaps the lower or more basic meaning is more pertinent here. This is something I sort of first kind of noticed when I was in Thailand, that there was a, when you know time came to go back to your kuti and spend the day there, especially when I had the great opportunity to stay in a monastery like Phudongkom, where we would just go back. I had a staying in a cave there, and you know we'd go back after the Dharma, and basically all day would just be in your cave. And so it's a long time. It's a lot of hours to spend just by yourself in a completely alone, no other human beings. You can't see anybody. You can't hear any other humans. And so, yeah, I noticed that even though I loved it, I enjoyed it, but still there was this kind of subtle kind of almost like a fear or resistance or something to the just the fact of really just doing that, just being alone. And even though I'm not a you know hugely gregarious person, I've been very happy spending many hours alone, even as a child, and that's never been a problem for me. But I just noticed that there was still that kind of slight resistance there, and so gradually overcame that after many years, until you know just to find that just feeling that just to be alone actually is the most it's a very very fulfilling state to be in. Aloneness isn't an absolute. Aloneness is just a sense of physical seclusion from others for a period of time. But the aloneness itself is dependent on those others. And very obviously, for example, when we do our solo retreats in our kutis during the rains retreat, that somebody's still providing food every day. And so when I stayed for the 2 weeks of the retreat, I wouldn't opened the door of my kuti, so I didn't even know who was bringing my food to me. Just the food would arrive, and so I literally didn't see anybody for that 2 weeks, except one day towards the end I opened the door, and as it happened Alex was there, and I asked what day it was, because I'd forgotten what day it was, so didn't know if my retreat was finished or not. So that was the only glimpse I got of a human being in that 2 weeks. So this is another thing which is very important, and it's a great, it's an incredible strength to have as a human being and in one's human life. This is a strength that doesn't nullify or negate the importance of relationships that we have. Okay, so to say that you enjoy spending time alone is not to say that you don't appreciate other people and other people's company and what we can learn with them and from them and share with them and grow with them and all of those things. So the companionship of a good friend, as the Buddha said in other suttas, is also extremely important for the holy life, the Kalyanamittata. So the good friendship is also very important. But the being able to stay one by oneself is also important. Both of these things are very important. So we take the time and different periods in the monastic schedule to do both of these things. Some periods we have more community involvement and so on, some we have more time in seclusion. And so each of you should try to do both of these things as best as you possibly can. And it's up to you to make that effort. It's not nobody can do it for you. Okay, so you can't, and don't mess things up by trying to confuse or one or the other of these things. Okay, so don't try to pretend that you can solve the problems that are important for, at a community level, by just avoiding it and going into your hut and into your kuti. That's the wrong way to go into seclusion. And similarly, don't distract yourself from developing your seclusion by getting too involved and too busy in the community. And both of these two things are extreme. The right way to practice is to know that when there is the opportunity to practice in seclusion, that you practice in seclusion 100%. And when there's the opportunity to practice in community, through contribution and sharing with others, that you do that 100%. And as long as you take that attitude, then you should be able to negotiate these waters without too much problems. Okay, and the final of the 10 reflections. Atinu ko me uttari manusa dhamma valamari jnana dasana viseso adhigato yena hambati me kale sa brahmachari hi putto namanku bhavisamiti. So, have I got any state of attainment which is higher than merely human or worldly dhammas, which is a distinction of knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, so that when I die on my deathbed and my friends in the holy life question me, I won't be embarrassed. Right? So this is referring to the exalted spiritual distinctions of the holy life, and technically it refers to jhanas, psychic powers, and the attainment of the various levels of stream entry and so on. These are things which are called the uttaring manusa dhamma, things which are beyond the human dhamma. And so this is referring to those higher goals and aspirations of the holy life. This course is a practice or a custom in the Sangha that we don't go around boasting about our spiritual attainments, and in fact not just boasting about it, but you shouldn't really go about talking about them at all. And best advice on announcing one's spiritual attainments was that advice given by Venerable Jnana Vimala, who's the most respected of all of the Western meditation bhikkhus. He's the one which is regarded by many as having the highest attainment of all. And when Ajahn Brahm went to see him many years ago, before he passed away, he said to Ajahn Brahm, you should never announce any spiritual attainments, even to yourself. Okay? So that's the standard which he had. Don't even announce it to yourself, much less to others. So the only real reason that you have to announce or tell anybody of any spiritual attainments that you might have is if you need to discuss it with a teacher. Okay? So if you think that you may have had a jhanic experience, or if you may have a psychic experience or experience of deep insight or something like that, and if you then that's something that should be discussed with a good meditation teacher in the appropriate context, in the appropriate time and place, but it's not something which should be bandied around in a public discourse, okay, and should not be a matter for public gossip. Okay, who's got this and who's got that, and they haven't really got this, and this isn't real, and blah blah blah, and that's all very cheap and a bit sad and pathetic, to be quite honest. So in some monastic systems they tend to talk about these things in public, and that invariably results in a culture of overestimation. And any place where you see monastics regularly talking in public about attainments of meditation and blah blah blah, and who's got this and who's got that, then you can take it for absolutely for granted that there is a lot of overestimation going on, because the ones who really have those kinds of abilities don't go around bragging about it. Okay? And even in isolated, there might be exceptions to that. So, for example, in Thailand in recent years, Ajahn Mahabua has become very famous and quite notorious for speaking about his own spiritual attainments in public. But he started to do that about 30 years after he actually had those attainments. Okay, so the actual attainments that he's talking about happened in the early 1960s, and it wasn't until the mid-90s that he actually started talking them about them in public. And so that gave him 3 decades to reflect and review and to continue his practice to make sure that he knew that what he was talking about was authentic and that it was the real thing. It's only towards the end of his life that he began to talk about it. And even that is then controversial. And certainly most of the other forest monks, like Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Chah and so on, wouldn't even do that at the end of their lives. If you hear talk of somebody discussing their superhuman abilities or attainments and jhanas and so on and so forth in public, then be skeptical. Don't believe them. Okay? In my experience, that people who have these kinds of things, generally speaking, don't talk about them in public. Unless there's a very good reason in a particular context. And to take that as a standard, if you have any experience that you think maybe a jhana or something like that, then please come and see me and we'll talk about it. And if I think that I can answer the question or deal with it adequately, I will. In some cases, if it's not an area or covered by my own experience, then I might recommend that you see another teacher for advice on that particular matter. But generally speaking, even in those cases, it's only really just to sort of check that you're going in the right direction, because sometimes these experiences can be very powerful and quite disturbing. And so that's sometimes some reinsurance and encouragement is useful at that time. Okay, so this is why this reflection is here, that at one's deathbed, that one is to be questioned about these things, because it's assumed that during one's life that one hasn't been going around boasting about it and talking about it and so on. So this is a reminder for us all that the holy life is not just lived in order to, you know, have a peaceful life or to have a good life or to be a good monk or a good nun or to propagate the Dhamma or to any of these kind of reasons, all of which are perfectly good reasons, but they're not good enough. They're not adequate. And actually, the holy life is lived for the realization of Nibbana. It's for the development of the Eightfold Path. It's for the realization of the truth. It's for abandoning the fetters that bind us to rebirth and bind us to samsara. It's for undoing the root cause which binds our consciousness into suffering. That's the purpose of living the holy life. So this reflection should remind us always of that context and that aspiration which is laying behind our going forth, so we don't get distracted by it, we don't get caught up in the little things. Little things are important, we look after them, you know, we make sure that the phones work, we make sure that the paths are swept, we make sure that the washing up's done after dana, we look after all of those little things, but don't let your holy life be taken over by them. Remember that the purpose of it is to realize these Uttari Manusa Dhammas. Sometimes they seem very far away. Sometimes we think, oh, that could never be me. I couldn't do it in this lifetime or whatever. It's simply not true. And you cannot say that. The mind is completely incredible in its potential. Far beyond the capacity of any of us to even imagine what the mind is capable of. And there are countless stories, both in ancient times and also in modern times, of people who suddenly the veil just lifts and their mind becomes clear. The pharmacists drop away. And this can happen either at a level of samadhi, it can also happen at a level of deep insight, penetration into the Dhamma. And you know, we know the story of the bhikkhuni who said she was wandering for 20 years and never found peace of mind even for the duration of the finger snap. So that's pretty bad, isn't it? 20 years. And then she tried going to hang herself. She's tied the rope around the branch of the tree and she's ready to jump off the tree and hang herself. So no one here is that bad yet. We might think our minds are pretty scattered and pretty bad. We're not quite that bad. And then her mind just got freed just then. It's right there. She just let go. So this is a very, very powerful story. The mind is just like that. It's just because we hold on that the suffering happens. All you have to do is let go. And any of us can do that in any instant. There's absolutely no reason at all why somebody just sitting right here shouldn't be able to let go at a very deep level. It can happen to any of us. So this is why we have to keep watching, keep alert all the time to make sure that that we're ready when the mind, when the conditions in the mind mature and start to ripen, that we're ready for them. So these are the 10 reflections of the Dasa Dhamma Sutta. And so as I mentioned before, we'll be chanting this for the next few weeks, and like everybody, especially the monastics and monastic candidates, if they haven't already, if they could make an effort to memorize this particular sutta. And certainly when you go traveling and go staying in different monasteries, this will be one of the chants which will be done regularly in the different places that you stay in. So I offer this talk for you this evening, and I'd like to invite if anyone has any comments or questions or reflections.
How does the layman or a monk, for me in particular, also a monk, I said, say layman, you try to practice the Dharma as well as possible. How does one guard against pride? Because pride's not mentioned much in the Buddhist literature, I've heard, but within Western culture, pride is something we kind of have a war to be afraid of.
Yeah, that's a very good question. Pride or conceit is one of the fetters which in Buddhism is supposed to overcome. But I think you're probably quite correct that it's something which is maybe more emphasized in the Western culture, Christian culture, as opposed to the Buddhist culture. And I think in a lot of Christianity, pride has been really seen as the primary defilement. For example, the whole myth of the throwing Satan out of heaven because of his pride, and so that's really a kind of major focus. From Buddhist point of view, pride is very important, but pride is seen as being not necessarily as such a primal defilement, but more as something which is also very subtle. Okay. So it has coarse form, like even the first of that reflections that we did tonight, that we're one young here, I've become without caste. So in a sense, that one of the aspects of that is the aspect of pride, because there's a lot of pride, especially with the Brahmins and things like that, with their caste. So this is, it's already implicit in those things. But at a subtle level, actually overcoming pride or conceit is one of the last or the most subtle of the fetters which is overcome in spiritual practice. So that on beginning a spiritual practice, we have pride and conceit about dumb things, our car or how much money we earn or whatever, and that's what we have conceit about. As our spiritual practice goes on, we tend to get conceited about our spiritual practice. And once I asked Ajahn Brahm about that, and what happens when you get attached to, you have good meditation, you get attached to the feelings of good meditation, he said, well, at least it's better than being attached to something really stupid. So spiritual pride, it's at least a more refined form of it. So it's not seen in Buddhism as being something which is worse than attachment to, coarse things. But it's felt that, first of all, we let go of our pride and attachment about coarse things. Gradually, as we do that, then you'll have a pride about spiritual things. But that's very natural. Okay, so it's completely natural that if you have good meditation, that you'll feel a sense of conceit about that. You know, and I think probably all of us have experienced that. If you're sitting in a group meditation with people, and then you've had a good meditation or something, and then you come out of it and you look, and then somebody's fallen asleep or something like that, and you know, you feel a sort of subtle sort of contempt or criticism for the other person. So that's always there. But mainly, what you have to do with that is just be aware of it. Okay, unless it actually starts to really become a problem. But I think for most people, the main thing is just to be aware of, be conscious, raise it into consciousness. Okay, that's pride there, and then just not develop it from there.
Yes. Maybe related to that, that just came to mind. One is that maybe danger in your spiritual life also is false humility, pretentious humility. And it reminded me of something I read recently that Golda Meir said to one of her ministers, "Don't be so humble, you're not that great." And then I was reminded of something. Ayakema said that whenever there's a sense of superiority, there's always a sense of inferiority. So when pride arises in your mind, you can reflect on that also. And I'm trying to find that as well.
Yeah.
And then a question about conceit, because a friend of mine came up with the idea, and I don't know if this makes sense in Pali, but that this translation of the fetter as conceit is incomplete, in that it should always maybe be the conceit I am, or the thought I am, and that conceit was a kind of Victorian translation of that, you know, the idea, just a thought, belief, and that it's not actually conceit in the way we use it, in the sense of coarse pride, that, and that's just kind of a misunderstanding, but you know, I haven't heard any teachers say that.
Yeah, okay, well, in terms of the translation, I mean, the term, Pali term is mana, in translation of conceit. I think the attempt there with using that word conceit for mana is because the root of mana is the same as the root manas, the mind. And the basic root of that is related to the root to measure. So the word mana is actually related to the root to measure. This is what mind measures things. And so the idea of conceit is, I think the conceit is also sort of suggest or imply the idea of a concept. Mm. So you conceive concepts. So you're having ideas of, especially equal, superior, inferior and equal. It should be mentioned to Bill that this is, in Buddhism, conceit is not just thinking you're better than someone, but also thinking you're inferior is another form of conceit. And thinking that you're equal is the third form of conceit. Okay, so yeah, in that sense, it's definitely not just, you know, pride or conceit in the ordinary way that it's taken to mean in English, but ultimately, it's any way of conceiving or conceptualizing or thinking in terms of the self involves a sense of conceit in some way or another. But yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, the phrase, come back to Jackie's point about the phrase, the conceit I am, is actually separate. I don't think you can adopt that as a translation idiom, because that's the idea of conceit I am is actually a separate phrase, is asmi mana. Mm-hmm. So, you know, asmi mana is conceit I am. And yeah, mana itself is just conceit. But you also have the conceit or the idea I am that is another form of it. So there are different forms of the Pali with slightly different nuances.
I think the word mana come together with the word manyati. It means thinking about who I am. And in the term of your comparing with the other people,
yeah.
To form some contact with your right contact or wrong contact, interpretation and form some contact with the one child and compared to the other people.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
So the word conceit is not quite right with the word mana.
Yeah. Yeah, it's It's a very subtle, extremely subtle thing in the mind.
I have another thing. The first triple action on the Vevani, Vevani Yang, Akrutapa. It, the word Vana, it's not only your catch, it's original, it means color.
Color, yeah.
So it might mean the race.
Could be, yeah.
Race.
Yeah, without, you're without race, without nationality. Yeah, all of those things.
Without race.
With this conceit, if you recognise that you're measuring or comparing sort of a communication, is that sort of communication that conceit is there?
Absolutely, yeah.
So if you guard against and you know, measuring, comparing, looking around, the whole range of comparisons it could do, then that's sort of a good way.
Yeah, judging others as well. And of course, it doesn't mean you can't use your judgment.
No.
It just, you know, you use your judgment when you need to.
Mm-hmm.
But not to get caught up in a sense of identity around that.
Mm-hmm.
It's very close to the notion of identity.
Competition.
Yes, right. Compare and then competition, yeah. Okay, so maybe we can finish up there and finish by paying respects to the Triple G.
Patipanno bhagavato